good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Tim Phillips.
Tim, may the fourth be with you.
Yeah, may the fourth be with you, too.
Because we're recording on Saturday, which is May the 4th, and that's celebratory day for all things Star Wars.
Get out your lightsabers and... stormtrooper helmets and have a fun Saturday night. Yeah.
That sounds like every Saturday night at my house, but we'll go on. Anyway, End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We're here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the non-Star Wars political comedy Long Shot, although there are Marvel references in it.
Yes.
We might talk about that later. Because that's in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to talk about some of the latest movie news from the past week, including spoilers. Everyone's worried about spoiling or getting spoiled for Avengers Endgame, but are we spoiler crazy? And then we've already gotten our first best of the 2010s movie list, and it has some surprising entries, and we'll talk about that first top 20. And then finally, we've got a couple of very controversial movie trailers to discuss, one about a CG hedgehog, and one about a CG Will Smith. But first, we have to, and I mentioned this on the last week's show because I literally recorded it minutes after finding out that John Singleton had passed away, the trailblazing director of Boys in the Hood and Poetic Justice, the Shaft remake, and perhaps most importantly to all of movie fame, Too Fast, Too Furious. although I could make a case that Too Fast, Too Furious lays a lot of the groundwork for the franchise that the Fast and Furious movies become. And maybe John Singleton doesn't get enough credit for that. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, granted at the time it was like a gig. It was like, you know, John Singleton had no skin in that game, but, you know, he needed a job. And doing a Fast and the Furious movie seemed like a good job. But, you know, he introduces in that movie... the Tyrese Gibson character and the Ludacris character, and I think like those are like really key characters in like the franchise, like when we're going into 5 and we have the whole team dynamic. And you know, I would never make the argument that Too Fast, Too Furious is the best of the Fast and the Furious franchise, but maybe it's a more important entry in terms of the whole than we give it credit for, and I congratulate John Singleton for that.
Yeah, and it's probably his biggest box office he had in
that
any
too,
movie,
yeah.
too. So he probably doesn't need he probably didn't need the congratulations at the time. He was probably pretty happy with that.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's often these franchises, they start with a top filmmaker. Like, I think, like Mission Impossible, Brian De Palma did the first one, and then it became a huge franchise after that.
Mm-hmm.
So going with a trusted filmmaker who knows, who's got the tech background behind him, who has a lot of experience, probably is what they were looking for with that film. And kudos to him. It went really well and started this whole franchise, which probably wasn't expecting when he took the gig in the first place.
No, and of course, you know, he didn't come back. But, I mean, I think he leaves a legacy there. But I think more important, you know, we don't want to discount his legacy. You know,
let's just talk about Too Fast, Too Furious.
I know, right? I think, you know, he's done a lot of TV in recent years. I mean, that's not like the director's jail it used to be. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of directors who, like Steven Soderbergh, who go to TV to have more creative freedom and to not have to direct franchise things. But, you know, I think... going back to John Singleton's beginnings, I think that's really important. You know, he's the youngest Best Director nominee that there's ever been.
And he deserved it. Like, Boys in the Hood was such an amazing film.
Yeah.
And it really, really touching film with a great cast. And he really, really brings you to Compton, right? You really feel part of the environment. And you can feel for the characters. Even if you're not from there, you can really feel for what they're going through, the whole family dynamic in that film.
Right. And there's an image of what was, at the time, South Central Los Angeles. I think they rebranded that area because of all the negative connotations of that. But, you're right. It grounds that area in a sort of humanist, like that, you know, and that was ground zero for, you know, Rodney King and, you know, the LA riots and just, you know, it became like the 90s image of urban decay. Mm-hmm. And you don't see that in the John Singleton's vision, probably quite pointedly, because, you know, that's his neighborhood. Those are his people. Mm-hmm. that you see the humanity. And what I find interesting is that, you know, Boys in the Hood kind of launched this. They're not exactly blaxploitation movies, but, you know, it's almost like a new wave of blaxploitation movies in terms of, you know, black artists being able to tell their own stories.
Right.
Where you get, like, things like Menace to Society and New Jack City.
Dead Presidents.
Yeah. And also you get, like, parodies like Don't Be a Menace to South Central While Drinking Your Juice in the Hood, which was, I think, a Wayne Brothers movie.
Yeah.
But in terms of, like, setting that aesthetic, I think people overlook the fact that Boys in the Hood and even more so Poetic Justice are very down-to-earth tales, very human tales of the people in these areas for all their inconsistencies, for all their warts, for all their, you know, basic goodness that can sometimes be just plastered over because we look at this thing called South Central and we remember the urban decay and we remember the violence, we remember the gangs and all that. And it's a reminder just how much surface there was. And in sort of looking back at that time, it was just only kind of a surface appreciation of what it's like in that area. And we forget that they're very human people there.
For sure. Like, he was a humanist director. He really cared. And that could sometimes, from a critical perspective, people could say maybe it's a little overwrought, some of his movies. I really, like, even Boys in the Hood, I think, got some criticism like that. But that to me is like a masterpiece of the time. And it's great that he was nominated for Best Director like 2 years after Spike Lee was totally snubbed for Do the Right Thing.
Right, right.
With, like, one of the best movies ever. And then just a couple years later, he did Boys in the... Or John Singleton did Boys in the Hood. And I think the time was right for that. And that helped with the nomination, that the past snub kind of helped him. But I think he really deserved that nomination. And
sometimes there's a backlash. Yeah. And it helps the, you know, and Spike Lee can probably attest to this better than most people, that, you know, if it hadn't been for Do the Right Thing, maybe John Singleton's nom for Boys in the Hood doesn't happen. And it's important to note, like, the number of black Best Director nominees, you can still count them on one hand.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, whatever, you know, little bits of sort of like breaking through, it's always never enough. And John Singleton, Boys in the Hood, and I think Poetic Justice goes even more into that humanist direction, because it doesn't even, like, it's about people who are affected by violence, but it never actually, you know, goes into depicting the violence. The violence is always kind of off screen, and you're confronted with the fallout, and, you know, with the Janet Jackson character and Tupac Shakur, who. Mm-hmm. Who knew he could, you know, be such a great actor? He's really good in that movie. And, you know, who knows what he might have done.
And John Singleton did well with rappers, because Ice Cube and
that's
Boys
right
in
too,
the Hood.
Yeah.
And then Tupac Shakur and Poetic Justice. And Poetic Justice is a very humanist film as well. And it's just great chemistry between Janet Jackson and Tupac Shakur. And I'm sure John Singleton created that environment where they could just feel free and act. And Tupac Shakur, who wasn't used to being a film actor, had room to breathe, I'm sure, and he did a great job.
He's really great with actors, because even the Shaft remake, that I know there aren't a lot of fans of, but I mean, there are great performances in that. Jeffrey Wright, who is largely a stage actor, until that movie. That's a kind of like a revelatory performance. Like, his character Peoples Hernandez is such like an oily but oddly lovable figure in that movie. He's such a great villain. He's so over the top. There's a scene where Shaft kills his brother, and he comes out of the car and he starts screaming at Shaft, going, "You best kill me!" And he's stabbing himself in the chest with an ice pick while doing it. And it's like, equally like frightening and hilarious at the same time. So John Singleton had a real gift of finding actors and giving them good material, whether that's, you know, something, you know, basically silly like Shaft, or something like deeply serious and personal like Poetic Justice, mm-hmm. or even Rosewood, which I think is overlooked. Mm-hmm. Rosewood, I would almost, I haven't watched it in a while, but I mean, in sort of revisiting the John Singleton's filmography, you know, I wonder if that would feel a bit like the Black Klansman of 97, 98 when it mm-hmm. was released, like this, like deeply, not necessarily the whole Black Klansman, but you know, the story that the Harry Belafonte character tells about the man who was lynched in 1916, which would be roughly the same time as Rosewood. Mm-hmm. Like that sort of like deeply personal slice of dark, deep American history where, you know, almost being black was a crime mm-hmm. in and of itself. Mm-hmm. And that like white people and Klansmen like basically laid siege to a city of mostly black people mm-hmm. in 1923. Mm-hmm. I think that's an even more important story now and maybe should be revisited, especially in the wake of John Singleton's untimely passing.
Yeah, so this could be a good opportunity to look back at some of those films, like you're mentioning Rosewood, because I looked back. I barely remember it, to tell you the truth.
Yeah,
I don't know. I don't even know if I watched it, but it's like 20 years old or so.
It's, yeah.
Yeah, I was looking back at like some old reviews, and there's reviewers who are really sticking up for the film. This is a great film. You need to see it. Mm-hmm. But people at the time are like, I don't want to see a movie about lynching. You know, it's
not, right.
There was a lot of backlash at that time where right. people didn't want to go to this Cineplex and see that.
Yeah.
Whereas I think today, given, success of Black Klansman and some of these recent movies, mm-hmm. and given the untimely death of John Singleton, the time is right to look at that. And
right.
I'd be interested in seeing that film for sure, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll have to leave that for another time because we have to talk about a very, very important topic, which is people who spoil Avengers Endgame for people. I find it funny that there's actually like an expiry date for spoilers that like Disney and Marvel have come up with, like May the 6th. So the Monday that's just passed, we're recording before, but you know, when this comes to air, May 6th will have passed. So you can freely talk about spoilers about Avengers now. Disney commands it.
Yeah.
But I find I'm kind of two minds of this, that, you know, there was, first of all, yeah, it's nice to go into something fresh.
Mm-hmm.
Second of all, I think there are a lot of people who take it too far. I think there are a lot of people who are like, I don't even want to watch trailers. I don't want to, you know. And meantime, there's this whole cottage industry of fan sites that will dig for every little spoiler. And I feel like it's the negativity both like feeds itself and repels itself, because fans don't want to be spoiled. But who are these fan sites? Like, I found one on Polygon that was like, Avengers Endgame toys spoil the movie. And it's because, you know, certain characters are in certain costumes or depicted a certain way. And it's like, and it's like, well, who's going to this site? Movie nerds who want, like, desperately want to watch the Avengers Endgame and be unsullied going into it. Mm-hmm. So who is this article for?
No, I think people almost want to be sullied there.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's how it is. I think back, like, going back again 20 years, while you're talking about John Singleton, back, like, spoilers for, like, The Usual Suspects and Crying Game.
Yeah.
You didn't have the internet, you know, at where it is now. You didn't have these fan sites. You didn't have social media with Twitter. So there was inferences. And I think before I saw Crying Game, I kind of figured out what the inference was,
right.
like what the spoiler ending was going to be. But now it's just like it's all over the place. So it's like people say they don't want to be spoiled, but they'll go on these sites. And obviously you're going to see something if you go on the site.
Right. And the other part of it, too, is that there are people who are just going to be like blatantly jerky about it. And I remember when the 6th Harry Potter book came out. And people are like lined up in front of a bookstore waiting to buy it, and somebody drives past and yells out the window, Dumbledore dies! Sorry, spoilers for Harry Potter 6. But, you know, it's like,
yeah.
And so I was listening to some podcasts, and they were talking about how there were, like, kids came out of the movie and started, like, gabbing and spoiling, like, purposely being little jerks.
Yeah.
And I feel like we're kind of, as in, like, many things in modern society, we're kind of at the poles where it's like you have some people who, like, want to just completely – I heard somebody on one podcast say this. Like, when it comes to Star Wars Episode 9, they want to be put into – a medically induced coma, wheeled into the theater, and then revived just in time for the lights to go down.
Yeah.
And then you have, you know, people who just want to watch the world burn.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy. I think with some of these movies, if they're good enough, you can even be spoiled.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll still enjoy it. But it's just... Yeah, with all these movie universes now and everything, it's like especially with TV the way it is now, like how do you not get spoiled? You have to be up to date. You have to see something right when it comes out,
right,
or you're going to get spoiled. And there's people who are like two seasons behind on Game of Thrones or something,
right? I pity those people.
How do you not get spoiled, right? Like,
right.
It's.
I think there's also a matter of, like, if you're like that far behind. I remember having a friend who I watched Star Wars for the first time with her. I'd seen Star Wars many, many times, but this was the mm-hmm. first time she had seen Star Wars. But of course she knew, like, how Empire Strikes Back ends mm-hmm. with the reveal of Luke, I am your father. Mm-hmm. Spoiler alert for Empire Strikes Back. But
how dare you, Adam?
But I mean, I wonder, and maybe Disney and Marvel are onto something, like having an expiry date for not revealing spoilers and just saying, like, if you care deeply and passionately about spoilers, maybe see it before this date. Mm-hmm. I think it's silly, but on the other hand, maybe it's wise. Maybe it's wiser than I want to give it credit for.
Mm-hmm. Maybe they should have alternative endings.
Like the Clue movie. Yeah. So-and-so didn't die to save the world. So-and-so died.
Just bury it in the end credits of the movie. Just like there's an alternative ending.
I might be interested in that experiment, you know. Maybe not. You'd probably like drive some people crazy if you did that with something like Avengers Endgame. But, you know, maybe something like, I don't know, like the next... you know, murder mystery. I know Kenneth Branagh is working on another Poirot adaptation. So, like, maybe, you know, in one movie theater, it's revealed that the killer is, you know, the person who it is from the book, and maybe another theater, the killer is revealed mm-hmm. to be like the Riddler. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm getting my universes mixed up. But
or for
Poirot Batman crossover, it could work. I think.
Yeah, even for these, even for the Marvel movies, like the first week could just be like a different ending than they end up rolling out after that.
It's an interesting idea. I don't know if the big movie studios will go for it, being as risk averse as they are. But, you know, maybe Netflix could try something.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, they did that Bandersnatch episode of Black Mirror. Yeah. Where it was a choose your own adventure.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Maybe that is the direction. Maybe Netflix has been ahead of us the whole time.
Yeah.
All right. We'll not talk about spoilers there. And we're going to take a quick break and come back with a couple more topics. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU. So that was a bit of Patrick Park there. That is the song Long Shot. What might be a long shot is maybe Avengers Endgame ending up on the best of the 2010s movie list.
Depends which list.
Fair enough. Depends which list. But one website has already published their list. It is called World of the Real. They went to 250 film critics. And I learned something new. There are 250 film critics? No, I knew that. There's a lot more than that. They asked the 250 critics to come up with a top five. They combined the top five to come up with like a compendium of a top 20. And there are a lot of interesting titles on here. So number one is Mad Max Fury Road. Two is Tree of Life. Three is Moonlight. Four is Boyhood. Five is The Social Network. And I'll just read the rest of the top 20. The Master, Roma, Phantom Thread, A Separation, Inside Llewellyn Davis, Get Out, Under the Skin, Carol, Margaret, Tony Edmund, Uncle Boonie, Twin Peaks, The Return, Her, Call Me By Your Name, Active Killing, Inception, and Holy Motors. Active Killing, Inception, and Holy Motors were tied for 20. And I can't really...
Holy Motors. Have you seen Holy Motors?
No, I haven't seen Holy Motors, actually.
It is. It is like the weirdest movie. And I went to see it because I heard it's like weird. I like weird movies. Mm-hmm, and I just did not get it at all. It was just... I thought a total waste of time, but yeah.
Weird like... Yorgos Lanthimos, like Lobster, weird?
Or... No, like, I like The Lobster. I would have put The Lobster on this list, actually, but, like, Holy Motors, holy crap, that's a really weird movie. Like, not in a good way. For me, anyway. I don't know, like...
Well, to each his own.
Yeah.
What I find interesting is that the list is kind of bookended by, you have Mad Max and Inception, which are both kind of, like, weirdo blockbuster movies, like dressed up in like very straightforward action movie clothing. So it's weird you have like these kind of crowd pleasers like at either end of the list.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's maybe also a bit of PTA bias, which I think a lot of film writers have. Paul Thomas Anderson, not to diminish The Master especially, but I'm not sure we needed two PTA movies.
It's kind of like an obscurest list in a way, too, right? Like, it has the two Paul Thomas Anderson, like The Master, which I liked, but it was, it's not the best movie ever. Although I think at one point on IMDb, it was rated the best movie ever made or something like that.
So. I think it's a very good movie, but, you know, I may have like sort of like a bias for like taking shots at Scientology.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure, like Phantom Thread is like a very interesting like sort of chamber drama, and it's a really great Daniel Day-Lewis performance, and I can't remember the actress in it, but she's really great in that too. I'm not sure it would make my top 20.
I don't think most of these movies would make my top 20.
Yeah.
It's interesting they had Under the Skin, which probably wouldn't make my top 20.
Oh, I think it might make mine.
Very interesting movie, I think.
It's fascinating. Because speaking about not knowing what goes on, because like it's so real, like how it was filmed, like so visceral, and like it's kind of like the Ultima Dogma 95 movie, where, you know, you have some of these people that she's encountering talking with thick Scottish accents.
Apparently some of them weren't actors.
They weren't actors. People, they had Scarlett Johansson driving around talking
to
people.
Picking up Scottish guys. Yeah.
It must be a weird experience to think, to be at one of those guys and like going to see that movie is like, wait a minute, was that Scarlett Johansson not asking for directions at one time?
Yeah.
Tree of Life is another one I think that people think is deep, but, you know, like crawls up its own ass.
I agree with that. I didn't mind it. I'm a big Terrence Malick fan, and I was disappointed by that. And it's funny, that ends up on a lot of lists. Like, I think Sight and Sound, people are putting in their top 10, and it's, I don't know why.
Yeah. Carol's a very beautiful movie. I'm not sure how it ends up on the top 20. It may be just, you know, the sample size. Social Network 2, I like a lot. I'm not sure it should be number 5. It could be in the top 20.
Yeah, it's, like I said, it's kind of an obscure list.
Yeah.
There's a lot of films that I would put on there that aren't on there, like Birdman.
Yeah.
Lobster, that's kind of, I like it. But Lady Bird, Shape of Water, I like. But it, each teaches his or her own. But Drive is a great movie.
Drive, yeah. I mean, there's so many films that kind of have that tone, mm-hmm. right? That I'm not sure what it is. It's sort of like feels like a very individualistic sense on the part of the director. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it really clicks in something like Drive. But if you go and watch the other ones that Rifin did recently, Neon Demon, which is just nuts, and then the one he did after Drive with Ryan Gosling, where it's just Ryan Gosling punching people for 2.5 hours. I can't remember what it's called.
Yeah.
Those sort of less, there's like sometimes these things really click, and I think that's one of the interesting things about those movies we're talking about. Another thing I don't understand is how Twin Peaks The Return is on this.
It's one of these lists. And the funny thing is, with you're saying 250 film critics, mm-hmm. it's like you look at some of these lists sometimes and they're, I know, like Cahiers du Cinéma in France, they purposely, I think, in their top five will put like the most obscure movies. Yeah. Or like ones that were reviled, they'll just pick like one of those
right.
just to stir the pot, I think, right? Like, yeah.
Maybe. I think Twin Peaks sort of feeds this idea that there was part of this, too, when O.J. Made in America was nominated or made the shortlist for best. I think it was fully nominated for best documentary, but it's a 5-part miniseries, 7.5 hours. And it's just like, no, it's not a movie. It's a miniseries. They made a miniseries. Just because it got played at a couple of festivals doesn't make it a movie. And I think people are all too willing to go so far into the idea that TV is the new film, that we have to elevate TV to the film. And I think David Lynch would probably agree with me, because I think David Lynch really likes the TV format, and I think he would strenuously disagree that what he made was a movie. He mm-hmm. made an 18-part miniseries mm-hmm. in the most David Lynchian style.
Mm-hmm.
So get it off the list.
Yeah. The ones I would agree with on the list are, and I really like Boyhood.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was great. And it was very experimental going over the course of 12 years, but it felt like a real life of this boy.
Yeah.
Get Out, I would probably put on my list.
Yes.
It's an amazing film.
Yeah.
And I really liked Her. I thought it was really good. And I almost forgot about it, but it's on this list now because it's from like 2011, I believe. So.
Yeah.
And
there's not too much recency bias on the list, which I appreciate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with the exception of maybe, and actually, I'd probably put Moonlight on this list. But yeah, Call Me by Your Name. I don't know if it might. I mean, I'd have to like sit down and write my own top 20, and maybe we'll do that later this year. But yeah, it's a fine list, but there are some questionable things. Also questionable, the Sonic the Hedgehog movie trailer. which
I loved. That's
you loved it.
It's number one on my best films of 2019. Sonic the Hedgehog trailer.
I think what it feels like is Jim Carrey hit his head and he forgot that the last 20 years have happened, and he thinks he just finished Ace Ventura: When Nature Calls.
Well, I just saw Liar Liar the other day, and I'm like, yeah, he's back. And I see this trailer and I'm like, yeah, bring back the 90s.
He plays Dr. Robotnik, who's the main villain in the Sonic the Hedgehog video game series, which I have wasted a lot of time playing. There's a CGI Sonic the Hedgehog in it, and it looks so bad that the director's already talking about fixing it. James Marsden, like, I realize that James Marsden probably hasn't had the career he thought he would, but in the trailer, he looks genuinely confused about how he's in a Sonic the Hedgehog movie.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure.
And I'm confused why the trailer uses Coolio's Gangster's Paradise as well.
the only thing I can think of is, like, it's from 1995. Sonic the Hedgehog's from 1995. Because otherwise, contextually, thematically, it makes no sense.
They're just picking random 90s 90s songs and visuals. And Jim Carrey, acting like, could have been in a mask or something, the way he's acting in the trailer.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really quite bizarre. And I don't know who, I wrote down, somebody wrote on Twitter, what exactly is this movie supposed to be? The Mary Sue had an article about that. What exactly is this movie supposed to be? I have no idea what this movie is supposed to be. It just seems like we got Sonic the Hedgehog's movie rights. Let's do it. And there's a lot of that going around in Hollywood. We've got rights and we should use them. See Disney. But I'm not sure there's any appetite for seeing a photorealistic Sonic the Hedgehog. I'm not sure there's any appetite for seeing Sonic the Hedgehog in a real world versus real army guys. I'm not sure there's any appetite for seeing Jim Carrey in a ridiculous mustache. I feel sorry for Neil McDonough. He's paid his dues in Hollywood, but he's got to be...
Well, now that you told me the director wants to fix it, I'm a little concerned. Yeah. But I was going to say, Adam, I wouldn't be surprised, because it's kind of like funny in that sort of 90s nostalgia way, and that it could be... I laughed at certain parts of the preview, and it's just ridiculous, right? There's a cop with the radar gun, and Sonic the... Oh, what was that? Sonic the Hedgehog did 720 down the highway right. or something. It was like... Yeah, this is quality entertainment.
All right. There's also Gemini Man, which is, I think it's Looper directed by Michael Bay, even though it's directed by Ang Lee. Mm-hmm. Somehow it's directed by visionary director Ang Lee, mm-hmm. who I think watched every Michael Bay movie in preparation for this, which is not good. Mm-hmm. But it's old Will Smith versus young Will Smith. And they're both assassins.
We need more Will Smith, basically.
Apparently.
Yeah.
If it hadn't been for the fact that Looper had done this literally like 5 or 6 years ago, I might be more interested in this. Mm-hmm. But the only thing that is different is that there's no time travel mm-hmm. because the trailer makes it explicit he's a clone. Mm-hmm. But the only thing that really makes it different is that it's going to Will Smith is playing the two parts, and Will Smith is de-aged to play the younger one. And that is tricky because I feel like you could do that for, you know, Michael Douglas for like brief periods in the Ant-Man movie. And, you know, most kids today going to watch Ant-Man probably haven't, you know, sat down and watched early Michael Douglas and, you know, something like Romancing the Stone mm-hmm. or the original Wall Street or what have you. Mm-hmm. I think people very much have a very clear vision of Will Smith, of young Will Smith, mm-hmm. whether that is Independence Day, whether that is Fresh Prince. Mm-hmm. It's going to be tricky. I mean, I will give the trailer credit that it looks pretty good in the trailer, but can they sustain that for the whole movie is my question. Is it going to hold up?
Yeah. And will Will Smith have like a sideways hat on during part of that? shooting and, a basketball or
and will DJ Jazzy Jeff have a cameo?
Yeah.
Because I have a feeling he's not doing much nowadays.
He should be in it.
What they should have done is have Will Smith as the old and DJ Jazzy Jeff as the young, and then, you know, like really like mess with people.
Yeah.
That way.
For sure.
Like DH, DJ Jazzy Jeff.
Yeah. I don't know. They could have done that. Yeah, I think, yeah, Will Smith, it's, I don't know. It's interesting because he used to really, I thought was a really exciting actor. I thought Fresh Prince was really good, his early movies. And now it's kind of like blah. It's like a Will Smith movie. I'm not too excited about it.
It's interesting because, this seems like another callback for him. This seems like a movie Will Smith would have made in like 1998 or 2000 mm-hmm. Where... It's like the Will Smith movie for this year. Mm-hmm. And he's taken interesting chances with like 7 Pounds or After Earth, like both movies that are like drastic, drastic failures. But I mean, he's also done like things like The Pursuit of Happiness.
Mm-hmm. That was a good one.
Yeah, where he's very, very good. I was just thinking about another one that he did, Focus. Where he's a con man with Margot Robbie, mm-hmm. that is a really enjoyable film where mm-hmm. It uses him very, very good. But yeah, this does seem like generic Will Smith action movie number 10.
Yeah.
and another thing is there are 6 screenwriters credited on IMDb.
It's not, that's usually not a good sign.
Including Billy Ray and David Benioff.
Wow.
One of the co-creators of Game of Thrones gets a credit on here. Wow. Oddly enough.
Maybe. I don't know. Maybe it's worth watching. Is it based on a book or anything, this? Or,
it's based on like a script that's been kicking around Hollywood for like 20 years.
Okay.
Because they haven't been able to do it because of the technology. Like, mm-hmm. apparently it's the movie that Jerry Bruckheimer's been working on the longest.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that.
Yeah. I think Sonic the Hedgehog, though, is a winner.
Sonic the Hedgehog will be the winner.
It will be.
In this October, because I think they both come out in October.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's a long shot. Speaking of which, that is the movie we're reviewing this week, and we will review it right after our normal musical break. You are listening to End Credits here on CFRU, 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
How does that work with you? Do you like date?
Yeah, I date. Generally, you know, with people who have similar lifestyles to me, people who travel a lot. It's hard to keep those things alive. I mean, who wants to follow me around the world and hope I have 5 minutes to be affectionate?
Yeah.
And honestly, guys don't really want to date women who are more powerful than them. They think they do, but it's a tripler.
Oof.
Mm-hmm.
Tripler is my favorite Batman villain, though, so. You gonna ask why I'm still single?
No, I get it. It makes sense.
Yeah, it adds up.
And that was a clip from The Long Shot. It is the new film from Jonathan Levine, and it stars Charlize Theron, Seth Rogen, June Diane Raphael, O'Shea Jackson, Bob Odenkirk, and a barely recognizable Andy Serkis playing Rupert Murdoch. I mean, Parker yeah. Wimbley.
And Justin Trudeau's in the movie as well.
I think you mean Alexander Skarsgård yes. as Justin Trudeau, as the Canadian Prime Minister, who I don't think gets named. I think he's just the Canadian Prime Minister.
I think they gave him a name. It's like an English name for some reason, even though he's
yeah,
like talking
but it's in French. It's very clearly modeled on you know who.
Yeah.
But I think it's clear that maybe the movie there's two thoughts in the movie, and I think you can sort of see that in the two screenwriters. You have Dan Sturley, who is he's written for a lot of sitcoms like The Office and The Grinder and things. And he also co-wrote The Interview, which is this Seth Rogen movie where him and James Franco are sent to North Korea by the CIA to kill Kim Jong-un. That caused so much trouble a few mm-hmm. years ago. And then the other screenwriter is Liz Hanna, who co-wrote The Post. So there's a kind of very bifurcated element in the screenplay where it's like clearly somebody who's kind of aware of politics and someone mm-hmm. who kind of doesn't care about politics,
mm-hmm.
but somehow it works.
Yeah,
I think it works very well. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was very funny. I think the two leads really carry the show.
Oh yeah,
Charlize Theron and Seth Rogen. Like, there's great chemistry between them, and Charlize Theron. She's just such a great actress. It seems like whatever genre she's in,
yes.
she's able to carry a movie.
Yeah, and she does a lot of. She's very funny in this. I mean, she's obviously the straight woman, but she mm-hmm. she can be very funny. And I feel like she's one of these sort of rare people who can sort of rise to any occasion. You can't pigeonhole her as an actress. She's good in action. She's good in drama. She's good in comedy. Mm-hmm. And she's very good here. And it's not a hard, or I should say, it's not an easy thing to believe that a woman who rises to the level of Secretary of State of the United States and seems competent and accomplished in the job would fall for Seth Rogen as basically a Vox journalist who will punctuate every headline with a swear if he can.
FX on is this big article.
Right. Yeah. It's not easy to sort of sell that as a plausible romance.
Mm-hmm.
But it sells you.
Yeah.
It actually sells you, and there's some there's actual genuine sort of touching romance. I mean, there's a lot of the, frat humor that Seth Rogen is well known for, but there's heart. There's actually a lot of genuine heart.
Yeah, and we were talking about humanist filmmaking earlier, and this is very humanist as well. And what I like is, especially in politics, politicians are seen, they're supposed to be perfect, and then anything becomes a scandal, right?
Right.
And human beings at the end of the day, even Charlize Theron, okay? I think people think of her, she's got supermodel good looks.
Yeah.
She's so composed on the screen. She does a lot of charity work and all this stuff but she probably laughs at fart jokes, you know?
Yeah.
It's get through the facade, and that's something true of politics. And I was just thinking now of even Charlize Theron as an actress, where people have these preconceived notions, but everybody's human. And that's what I liked about this story is she fell for this guy who he's not a GQ guy, but that happens in real life too, right? That's
it can happen.
It can happen.
There's a very, and maybe I'm more, because I'm more steeped in the political side in another life, but there's a very sort of modernist reading in this, especially in the end when she makes the big speech. And this is a very formulaic movie, but when you do the formula well, it still works. There's a reason why the formula works.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's a message at the end of the film, and not to tie everything back to Trump, but I think the thing that people who love Trump, what they love about Trump, they know he's a short-fingered vulgarian.
Mm-hmm.
They love that he doesn't care that he's a short-fingered vulgarian.
Yeah, he's not trying to cover it up somehow. He's covering up other things, but
he's not covering up
his personality flaws.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's an interesting message to sort of take into an actual American election year, Canadian election year too, actually, is that people don't mind that you're human. Mm-hmm. People mind that you pretend not to be human more than the fact that you are human.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that there's also a correlation to that in romance as well, that people desire perfection in romance and in relationships, and get frustrated when they are not presented with perfection or when they do not achieve perfection. And you know what? You work with the romance you have, not with the romance you want. And, there's something to be said about being okay and building something with someone you are compatible with, even if they don't present as the perfect person.
Mm-hmm.
And there's that scene where the aide to Charlize Theron's Secretary of State comes in and says, with this presentation that, basically says that Seth Rogen is too schlubby for her. And that really kind of sums that up nicely. You can't really think of these things in sort of a survey kind of way,
right,
in terms of what people are thinking. And, we really shouldn't. And while all this stuff is sort of going on in the subtext, it can also be very funny too. And there's a lot of great lines. And O'Shea Jackson, coming back to Son of Ice Cube.
Yeah, he's hilarious.
Yeah.
His friend, Seth Rogen's friend, who's running this company or something, right? He's just this really successful businessman.
It's never really explained what his company does.
I don't know. just the best boss ever.
He's best boss. I'm going to go out and get my friend drunk because he got fired, and we're going to all take the rest of the day off.
You all have the day off, yeah.
So he doesn't run an emergency room, clearly.
Yeah.
But but yeah, there's a lot of great cast members in this. I like Bob Odenkirk as the TV president who becomes president, which is sort of like a a kind of pointed Trump reference, because clearly someone who's not, although I did, he's watching his old TV show at one point, and there's a line about, like, I will not be the president who nukes a tsunami.
Yeah.
Which is just a completely absurd line. Yeah. But it's so funny. And
there's a moment, too, where you think there's an emergency.
Right. She's,
Secretary of State Charlize Theron's called into the Oval Office, and he's just running lines.
He's running lines for his, because, yeah, he's not running for re-election because he's going to make the transition to film.
Yeah, he's going to do the reverse Ronald Reagan, I guess.
Yeah. So, Bob Odenkirk's really good. Like, Andy Serkis, I did not know that was Andy Serkis.
Neither did I.
It's, because I was reading something about the film after it, and it mentioned Andy Serkis. Like, Andy Serkis wasn't in this. I know what Andy Serkis looks like. And there wasn't like some sort of Gollum thing in this. But no, he was playing a Gollum.
In a way, he was kind of Gollum.
And yeah, he's very, very good, but you know, it's very clear that Parker Wimbley is supposed to be Rupert Murdoch. And
right.
They
satirize Fox News quite a bit, really. Like, that's what Wembley is like Fox morning shows and stuff.
And I think some of that sort of falls flat. There's a scene, there's a couple of things that seem kind of thrown in there because to make them timely, like O'Shea Jackson at one point yells Wakanda forever. It's kind of just thrown in there. And then there's another scene where it does what's in a lot of these films where it shows like TV networks and clips and things, and one guy in the corner, part of the Wembley network, says like, coming up next, should a woman be president? We have a panel with Jeremy Piven and Brett Ratner. Yeah. It's like, yeah, some of the worst, you know, Me Too people. It's, yeah, we get it. Ha 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 ha. Yeah. They brought in a panel of scumbags to talk about a woman being president. Yuck. So some of that doesn't work. I think when the film focuses on Charlize Theron and Seth Rogen and their unlikely coupling, I think that's really good. And I think that's when the film is at its best. And, you know, it can be gross, but it can be sweet too. And the Roxette song has a very particular role in the movie.
Yeah.
And this is sort of where Jonathan Levine sort of brings his director's touch in. It's this really actually kind of lovely scene where they're in the kitchen at this diplomatic soiree, and Seth Rogen and Charlize Theron are in the kitchen dancing to Roxette, and the camera zooms out through the window to the kitchen, and you see the rest of the thing happening, and you know you sort of left, you know, seeing that this moment of romantic intimacy in the midst of this, you know, tremendous diplomatic occasion.
Well, there's good contrast there because Jonathan Levine, he had Charlize Theron dancing with the Trudeau character.
Yeah.
And he's the one that all the aides want her to be with
because
he's good looking, he's popular. And so she dances with him in this ballroom and she has to ignore Seth Rogen. She doesn't want to. She wants to be with him, but she has to ignore him for her political purposes. And then she sneaks out into the kitchen and does a slow dance with him, which is way more passionate than the one.
And I'm so glad they didn't go to the route of like him being jealous. Like there's, he sends her a note where he says on a cocktail napkin and it says like, look, I found Hitler, and he kind of nudges, and it's a kind of, cause he makes a joke earlier, cause they're in Argentina. He makes a joke earlier. Hey, I bet some of the people who killed my grandparents are here. Yeah. it's walks the fine line, but having said it, it sets up this thing for this later I found Hitler, which gives them a nice connection. But there's never a thing where, you know, she's like having to, you know, work with the ridiculously handsome Canadian prime minister. He's like, this is BS, this is ridiculous, you're a flirt, and like he appreciates that she's a powerful woman in a powerful position. And we see that later at the end of the film where you know, we see them later in the relationship, shall we say, and he's very shown to be very comfortable in his position, enjoying this, shall we say, historic position he finds himself in, and we'll leave it at that. And I do like that about this movie, that, and it goes back to the clip we played, that, you know, most men think they want to be with a powerful woman, but they don't. But I like that the Seth Rogen character clearly doesn't mind. Mm-hmm. Like being with a woman who takes the lead and who's on the mission, and him being the guy who's supporting the mission. Mm-hmm. And he goes through a thing too, where he's just like this, the guy who's like against everything and is the typical curmudgeon, and he has to come around to, you know, she has to be diplomatic. She's the one who's actually getting things done. She's not the one who's like typing things and shouting into the void on the internet and social media and all that. And mm-hmm. so the personal political stuff really balances well.
I think it does. Yeah. I think there's some moments where it didn't work, but they're mm-hmm. so brief yes. in the yeah. scope of the film, and you're so charmed by the leads that
it's so rooted in character.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we get some nice shout outs to the 90s. We get some good 90s yeah. porn.
90s, I wasn't too into, but like Boys to Men, that's their. They go see Boys to Men at a yeah. party, and that's yeah. how they meet again.
Right.
And it's like they're both Boys to Men fanatics, and I'm wondering how many Boys to Men fanatics were there. I guess they're popular, but
it's, I mean, there were enough that the cameo from Boys to Men is meaningful to people, mm-hmm. but probably not enough that this isn't the best promotion Boys to Men haven't gotten in 20 years.
Yeah.
Could say the same about Roxette too.
Yeah.
But there was a line in this where they were like, after she makes a speech and she references 90210 in her speech, and somebody comments that, oh, she's an Andrea Zuckerberg and inside a Kelly Taylor. It's like, oh, it took me a minute to, because yeah. I was never a 90210 yeah. fan, but I recognized the character's name. It took me a minute to, like, oh, right.
Yeah. And it's, that kind of goes to an older demographic, because a lot of the people I was watching movie like that were in the theater were in their 20s. So yeah. I think I was one of the only ones who laughed at that joke. So it's like, I guess they don't care. They're just going to, they don't care
can,
about their
can look it up after the movie on yeah. Wikipedia. But I think this is a, Jonathan Levine is an interesting director because he's done The Whackness, which is something I really, really like. He did 50-50, which was another Seth Rogen comedy. It was pretty funny. All the Boys Love Mandy Lane, which is a really interesting movie, I think. The Night Before, which is pretty funny. He has a very interesting oeuvre, where he's able to like do these like kind of really sort of human movies. I mean, Mandy Lane isn't funny, and The Whackness really isn't that funny, but you know, when he does funny, he's able to do it really well and still like really tell a story that is, you know, where it isn't just about the gags and stuff too. Mm-hmm. I think this is a winner. I have a feeling it's going to be bogged down because of, you know, Avengers stuff still going on. But mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know about the theater you saw it in. It was a pretty full theater.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I think there are a lot of people who want something. I was going to say want something more adult. I would not call this more adult. necessarily,
just,
but
yeah.
it's not like Avengers, and I think that that alone we can sort of be thankful that, you know, you can go in and watch something still rather
yeah, and it still has star power. So,
oh, absolutely,
like, that's what brings people in. I'm sure is like, oh, it's Charlize Theron and Seth Rogen, right? So
yeah, and they're an interesting couple, and Charlize Theron is again very funny, and you know, I what I'd be interested to see is like, let's put her and Chris Hemsworth in a movie together, because they're both like very beautiful people who also can be funny.
Mm-hmm.
And you know,
could do like an old school, like almost like an old Cary Grant type movie or something.
Absolutely. Or, yeah. We just have to get Chris Hemsworth to lose his Avengers Endgame weight, which is a spoiler, but we can use spoilers because the spoilers cap for Endgame has been lifted. So anyway, that is it for this week's show, and if you like it, you can surely listen to us again. You can find us on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can also download us on the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday, and that's at Podbean or through iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. You can find us on social media as well, on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show, and on Twitter at End Credits Radio. And Tim, if people want to talk about your presidential run, where can people find you on the internet?
Press conference tomorrow.
I almost Guelph, believed you.
Guelph City Hall. No. check me out, Flash in the Deadpan, on Facebook, Twitter. I've been writing a lot lately. I've kind of been in a writer's bubble, but I'm looking to collaborate some more, get back into like film and theater. So reach out to me. You can also email me at flashinthedeadpan@gmail.com.
Very good. And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can go to GuelphPolitico.ca for my political stuff. Stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio, and we will be back next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more end credits, and we'll see you then.